Magical Mystery Tour, a film by the Beatles. Yes, we made it up as we went along, I recall. I thought it'd be a good idea to just make a film, have some ideas, and go somewhere and film them. So I basically said to the guys, look, you know, have some ideas, and we'll pool them all and see if we can make something of it. So I think we had the song Magical Mystery Tour, which became the title. I think I wrote that. So we each dreamed up a sequence. John came up with a couple of dreams that he'd had. George came up with Blue Jay Way, which was based on a location in Los Angeles. So we each came up with a bit of an idea and went off in this bus to film it. And that's just what he gets. The incredible Magical Mystery Tour. So here we are. This is the bus and these are the characters in it. Couple of voluptuous girls to help us on the way. We had a real driver, which was helpful. And we had the bus painted. And then basically headed out of London with our driver, our courier, and his stewardess. We headed down south. We thought it might be a good idea to go towards Cornwall, where I think we'd had fond childhood memories. I'd hitchhiked down there when I was a kid. George and I had done that. So that's where we headed. So the story then started off with Ringo Richard B. Starkey and his auntie Jessie. What we did to find the actors and the actresses was we had a copy of an actor's directory called Spotlight. And we just looked through it for likely looking faces. And basically hired them on the basis of that, really. We didn't want to do lengthy auditions. And as we didn't have a very firm idea of what they were going to do, we just winged it.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to Magical Mystery Tour.
So we had Derek Royal, and he played Jolly Jimmy Johnson, who was the courier. Derek was a bit of an acrobat, so that was one advantage that we knew we could ask him to do one or two sort of little jolly tricks. Then we had Mandy, who was the hostess. So we literally got in the bus. I think there's echoes also of Hard Day's Night, where we got on a train and we set off. This time we set off on a bus. I think also the thing was, by this point in our careers, we wanted to have control over what we were doing, because that was happening in the recording studio. So we wanted to make this kind of sort of film based on almost like a cinema verite, like a reality show. So here's Ringo and Jesse. So they just add libbing. He comes up with the classic, you could do a bit of knitting, it'd do you good.
Who is that man?
So we devised ways to introduce the characters, and it was all very simple. And I would just talk to the actors and say, look, okay, we're going to set the camera up here, and Wendy's going to say to you, who's that guy? And that way we'll introduce Ivor Cutler, who was playing a character who at first didn't have a name, but he suggested Mr. Buster Bloodvessel, who then later became a singer of the same name, many years later. So we just worked out little bits of business and went on the trip. And then later, we introduced songs that had been kind of written with the whole project in mind. I see we're all smoking away. Don't do it, children. It's a bad habit. And then for The Fool on the Hill, I ended up just on my own going to the south of France with Mal, our roadie, and a cameraman. I think the thing was, you know, by that point in our careers, we were fed up of everything taking so long and everything being such a big fuss. And I myself had started making kind of home movies. I had a 16mm Bolio camera, French camera, which was great. I used to have a lot of fun with. And I would make these films and put a soundtrack to them. And they were kind of, I suppose you'd call them art films. So I thought, well, we could maybe try this same technique. So we did. We just got up in France very early in the morning in order to catch the sun rising. And then I just wandered around, talked to the cameraman. He said, this looks like a good shot. And then I just did various things while we played back the song. We didn't bother with sync. We didn't bother with keeping it very in time. And we didn't bother with things that proper filmmakers bothered with, like clapboards, in order to be able to synchronize the film and the sound later, which did end up as a nightmare when we got to the editing suite. But it also made the whole thing very simple to do and very instinctive. So that's how it was made. The filming of Fool on the Hill sequence took the morning. Basically, we were just in the south of France for a morning. And by the time we reached noon, the lighting had moved from where we wanted it. So I think we went back to the hotel just a bit later, got on the plane, and then filmed out of the plane window to get the setting sun and the clouds. So we would talk to the characters and they would put ideas in and we'd say, yeah, we like that, that's a good idea. It was quite a communal effort. One of the passengers there was our fan club secretary. It was kind of instinctive the way, if anyone had a little trick, like the old guy there could put his cigarette in his mouth and out again. So we'd see him do that. Say, that's good, yeah, do that. And we have Magic Alex, who came along, not being very magic. The town behind and heads for the country. We had to George Clayton.
Well, almost everything.
Who was a short guy. And we were really looking for the kind of Fellini characters that might be in a sort of Cirque du Soleil, a magical group. Our manager, Neil Aspinall, came in with a little cameo there just at the side of the road. Coach goes past him. And then we'd seen a play at the West End in which Victor Spinetti had done a fantastic scene where he was talking nonsense as a sergeant major. And so I said, well, that was such a great thing. Could you do that again for us for the film? So Victor did it, and it's particularly good. I just sat around as a sort of twitty officer. So, yeah, marvellous. And Victor basically took the whole scene over. He's a great actor, and also he's very good at improvisational work. And having dreamed up this character, I think himself was very at ease in this scene. I think we all just stood by and just enjoyed him. Then what would happen at the end of the day, we would just sit around. I'd sit around with the cameraman and review what we got, what we thought we had, what we thought we'd needed. And they'd say, oh, I think we needed a cutaway there. We didn't get it. So we'll get that tomorrow. So I think Victor Spinetti was particularly good. I suppose it helped that he was an actor. A lot of us weren't. And that, you know, led to a sort of crazy approach to the whole thing. And at first, people thought we were mad and just thought, oh, you know, it's completely indulgent. And I must say, I kind of took that on board and thought, well, yeah, it's certainly not untrue. It was pretty indulgent. But I enjoyed what we'd done and thought it had worked out in a quirky way. So I was surprised years later to hear, I think it was Steven Spielberg, say that they'd shown this and taught him about it in film school as an example of a different approach to filmmaking. So it finally found its place, and we had a good time making it anyway. I think the sequences were just suggested, often by memories from our childhood, often by things that we'd remembered or we remembered seeing or doing ourselves. So, for instance, Tug of War was something you'd see at all the village fetes. There'd often be a tug of war between the burly men of the neighbourhood. And so a lot of these things found their way in as ideas. I suppose the whole film has a bit of a village fete atmosphere to it. We found ourselves an old disused aerodrome where we could make up sequences. And again, that has echoes of Hard Day's Night, because Dick Lester had taken us to a disused airfield, and we'd ad-libbed certain little sequences in Hard Day's Night. So I think there's quite a few little memories of that, and I think what we liked about that was its informality. Even though this had less of a script than Hard Day's Night did, some of the sequences where we're just running around or chasing vicars and all sorts of odd people appear out of nowhere, I think that was really inspired probably by the informal scenes in Hard Day's Night. So you get motorcyclists, vicars, us, strong men, dwarfs, you name it, it was in there, because it was a magical mystery tour and we didn't know where we were going or what we were going to do. And so all the people who were our friends, like Mal Evans, our road manager and friend, found their way into many of the scenes. And I think the nice thing was a lot of our friends knew and were good at this impromptu behaviour. They knew our sense of humour. So you really would just have to say to Mal, Mal, just jump in the boot of that bus, will you, as it's going along. And he'd go, yeah, OK. And that was the spirit in which we made this film. I think that's really the nice thing about it. Yeah, we spent a day just zooming around this disused airfield with the bus, with George's Mini, with an Austrian Princess, which was a car we used to be ferried around with as the Weedles. There's always this black car would pick us up and drop us off. In the end, the most difficult thing really was to get the whole thing in sync, to put the sound and to marry it with the picture. In a conventional film, they had ways to do this very wisely. We thought, nah, it doesn't matter, we'll work it out later. Of course, when we got in the editing room and the editor said, well, where's the clapperboard? We said, oh, I don't think we put one on that. And he was much dismayed by this news. And it did mean that whereas we thought it was going to take a couple of weeks to edit it, it took more like 11 or 12 weeks, as I recall. But, you know, 11 weeks of fun. So here we have George, who's the photographer. So it would be natural that we'd line up and he'd take a picture of us. And he would come out of the camera with a little lion's head on. Yes. We would all smile. And that would be the end of that sequence. So we found our way down into the south of England, down sort of Cornwall, Devon way, just because that was a part of the country that we liked. And then the courier would say, if you look out of your left window, the view is not very inspiring, but if you look out of your right-hand window, it is, and that would give us an opportunity to put a sequence in. We made up a song called Flying one time in the studio using a mellotron, which is the lead instrument on it, which is sort of trombone sound. And then we just put a kind of 12 bar behind it. And it was something we ended up quite liking. So we thought, well, that's a nice enough song, could be a sequence. And we wanted it to, seeing as it was called Flying, we wanted the picture to reflect that. So we had a producer friend of ours, Dennis O'Dell, who was helping us put it together. And he happened to have some outtakes from a film he'd worked on, which was Dr. Strangelove. And I was chatting to him. He said, oh yeah, we've got loads of flying over mountains and stuff. I said, well, can we borrow it? He said, yeah. And that is what became Flying. Thank you, Dennis.
Beyond the blue horizon, far above the clouds, in a land that no one knows, live four or five magicians
And then we just write a little bit of dialogue to link it to the next sequence, which was the secret place where the eyes of man have never set foot. And then we would go to our next sequence. In this case, it was us all as magicians, which seemed fair enough, seeing as the title was Magical Mystery Tour.
Read the book.
And we'd each give ourselves a little bit of something to do.
Read the book.
And we basically improvise a sequence. With Ringo asking where the bus is.
The bus is 10 miles north on the Dewsbury Road.
And I would consult my astrological charts and let him know. In the background there would be Mal, our road manager, who would always be a great help if we needed someone at the back of a scene or in a bowler hat.
Meanwhile, back on the bus, things are happening, and life lobbles on.
In a way, the whole thing's like a home movie, but it's not real. It's, none of us ever went on a magical mystery tour, or mystery tours as they were known. So this is like, it's basically a dream, really. It's a little fantasy of what might have happened on our fantasy mystery tour. I suppose just as kids, hearing the term mystery tour set your imagination going, and I think we imagined far better things than would ever really happen. I think basically people went, took a few sandwiches and sang a bunch of songs and then ended up in Blackpool or Southport. Wandered around a bit and then came home. We have a sequence here with Ivor Cotler and Jesse Robbins on the beach. I think it was somewhere around Weston-super-Mare. Maybe not, not sure. And this was to be a sort of love scene where Ivor, or Buster Bloodvessel, as he is in the film, would fall madly in love with Jessie, and this would be our love interest. Now, Ivor is a wonderful deadpan comedian, poet, artist, who I knew from the London scene. So we set about doing this, and they went on the beach, and he made up all sorts of things. I don't know whose idea it was. You draw a heart around her in the sand. But it had a sort of strange little romantic quality, like a sort of weird little French film or something. Anyway, what happened eventually, we put it together and we thought, that's kind of touching, that's nice. But when we took it to the BBC, this was the one scene they made us cut out. And I couldn't fathom it for the life of me. I went to see a guy called Paul Fox, who was the head of entertainment or something, BBC. I had a meeting with him. And he said, no, we're going to cut that scene. I don't ever think I got a great explanation other than he thought it was weird. I thought it was kind of romantic. But this goes to show the power the Mighty Beeb has. They also paid us not very much money for it. Again, an example of the power of the mighty Beeb. In those days.
You know what I mean, don't you? Well, don't you?
Yes, Mr. Blunt Vessel.
I think the high spot for me was really the music. I think to be able to include I Am the Walrus was a great bonus for us. So we could do a sort of surrealist version to accompany the song, which itself was quite surrealist. We had our outfits made by a group of people we knew from London called The Fool, who used to read the tarot cards, hence the name, The Fool being one of the tarot characters. I always used to come out as The Fool. First I thought, oh, it's a bit lousy, couldn't I be a king or something? And they would say, no, that's a very good card. Never quite understood why, but it gained significance as the film went along. So again, we were at our disused airfield, and we set up. And then 1 minute, I had the walrus mask on. Next minute, John had it on. Because what happened was people were always reading into the Beatles lyrics. So we kind of knew that this would get talked about and people would try and work out who was the walrus, who was behind that mask. So we would actually set these false clues just for a bit of fun. And the walrus. And then we take it into the editing suite and ask the editor, now, what can we do with it? Any tricks? He'd say, oh, yeah, you've got these things called opticals. You could do. So, oh, great. Well, we can reverse this polarity, or we can put some little inserts in this bit of film. So we were at liberty to play around, and I think that's really what we wanted to do. We wanted to make a film that was echoed our playfulness and non-serious approach to what we were doing. So the Eggmen, which were characters from John's song, became us with skin wigs on our heads, bald wigs, and we just went out, and without any idea really of what we were going to do, we just filmed a lot of stuff with all the characters we had at our disposal. John had wanted to work with Nat Jackley, who's an old British comedian from our childhood. So in one of the sequences, I said to John, well, you just direct it, you just go out, take characters and make it all up in the spirit of the film. But I heard later that Nat was not too happy about that, because obviously these professionals were used to working with professionals who would obviously have a script or some idea of what they were doing. So I think he was a bit dismayed by the whole attitude. It probably is how most people in the world would know of Nat Jackley now. Because those days it was likely he might be forgotten, unless you were a student of British radio shows or early television. So in a way it was quite a good thing. And I think Nat's performance is terrific, because he's a natural comedian. Just the funny walks and the funny faces. And that was really all we needed.
Okay. Five little dicky birds.
So John here, sitting with little Nicola, who was the child of one of the people on the bus, and she was a nice little girl, and it was lovely to see John being so comfortable in playing with this little girl. And I think you can see by the sequence that she enjoyed what he was doing. But it's a side of John that you never really saw. And I must say, I don't think I'd really seen it much to that point.
Right. Should we give it to George?
So it's nice to have that captured on film.
Thank you. George.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Our estimated time of arrival for luncheon is approximately 1:15. Thank you.
Now shut up!
The sequence where Jesse, Ringo's auntie, says shut up to him and he turns on her. I think it probably shows his frustration. Luckily it turned into a little bit of comedy, but I think there was a hint of truth in it somewhere.
And she's dreaming. She's dreaming about food. Beautiful food. Lettuce.
I think the fun of doing it was having so many people who were prepared to improvise. So it became a real team effort. And one of the sequences was something when I was talking to John originally and saying, you know, think up sequences. He said, well, I just had this dream that I think it'd be great. I said, okay, fabulous. Well, tell me about it. And so he laid out the sequence where he was a waiter, which his stepfather had been a waiter in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool. So I think a little bit of it was based on him. And he did have slick back hair and a little moustache. So I think there was an affectionate nod to him in that sequence from John. But in his dream, he'd been piling shovelfuls of spaghetti onto Jessie's plate.
This time I mean it.
And she'd been...
I can't breathe anymore.
She'd been trying to eat it, and John had just been deadpan, just piling this stuff on her plate. And so this basically was John portraying a dream he'd had. I suppose that's in the great tradition of surrealist cinema. And Ivor Cotler was very much in tune with that kind of thing. He didn't flinch. He would just go along with it. He understood completely what we were doing. And... in a way, it's a kind of disgusting scene.
I don't care. This is the way he would have wanted it.
But the fact that it was based on a real dream gives it sort of validity. Why the hostess, Mandy, suddenly takes her top off and appears in a white bra is left to the imagination. After all, we were virile young men at the time. And I think this was an attraction.
Pirandello.
To be able to ask someone to take the top off and they would do it. In fact, a lot of people in the sequence end up taking the tops off, including Mal, the ubiquitous roadie. Bless him. Jolly Jimmy then feeds some milk to little George. We have various other characters standing around. Jesse is now talking to John. There we have it. In the sequence, it's Jesse's dream. But in real life, it was John's. So the story, if there is one, is that Jolly Jimmy is leading us around, showing us things, sights, places, and there's no more story than that. But we like the idea of that it would be more dreamlike and wouldn't have to adhere to any rules. Which also meant we could get all our mates in a film. And that's what we did. We also got all our mates into a little tent, which turned out to have a vast interior, which was a cinema. I think a lot of the films we'd seen as kids that had interested us were the ones that broke out of the mould of the, what you might call the proper films, the Hollywood films. There was a film that Dick Lester had done called Running, Jumping, Standing Still film that we loved. It was a short featuring Spike Milligan. And it was very surreal. And that was the kind of thing that we thought there should be more of. So when we came to make this, that was very much in our minds, that we would just dream up sequences and find ways to link them. Blue Jay Way was a song that George wrote, and he was staying in a house in LA, and we'd all arranged to meet him there. But there had been a fog, which had made us late. So that literally is the beginning of the song. And George put these real thoughts to Indian-style music, which was attracting him very much at that time. It attracted us all, but George was particularly attracted to it, so much so that he later went to learn sitar from the great master Ravi Shankar. And we became very interested in it, basically through George. So this song takes this real event of his friends being late, the fog in LA, and adds a mystical touch to it, where he uses a special lens that makes a kaleidoscopic effect, and then double exposures the film and uses tricks of putting a cat's face over his own to add to the surrealistic effect. The nice thing about it, you know, now, is that it's an interesting document of where we were at that time, that I think unless we'd taken this daring move of thinking, let's just do it ourselves, I don't think you would have ever really seen this side of the Beatles. Because when we came to make proper films, there would inevitably have to be a script, and someone somewhere would put us into a bag and make sense of what was going on. Whereas at this point in our history, a lot of what we were doing didn't make sense, and we were trying to come to grips with it. So this film shows that, and I think in many ways that's the value of it. I was making home movies on Super 8 camera and a 16mm camera, and doing a lot of double exposure. For instance, in the camera I had, you could run the film through once, then you could rewind and run it through again. So this would lead to quite surrealist effects. So I brought that hobby of mine into the making of this film. And the other guys would have similar interests too. So the film started to embody our own personal interests in a way that a more professional film probably wouldn't have done. In a way, it's a snapshot of the times. Looking through the Spotlight actors directory, we would see that various people would have special talents. There was Shirley, who was an accordionist. So she became, Shirley Evans, she became one of the people on the bus and just fell in with the general spirit of the film. But we always knew that at some point she would be able to whip out her accordion and give us a tune. I think, you know, what we would do is each of us would have
it's 10 miles north on the Dewsbury Road.
Have talents for impression. We would do silly little things with each other. We'd use the silly voices.
Could you tell me what's next on the agenda?
And I think each of us had a talent or a sort of wit, which I think was very much part of the Beatles. Whenever you'd see interviews or press conferences, it would come out. So I think it was natural that we would find a vehicle like this to allow us to express that. Here we go. The inevitable sing-along, which we knew had to happen on the Shara, as we called it, in this case, on the way home, which was the way to make a very boring journey a lot of fun. So Shirley, the accordionist, came into her own there. She knew all these old songs because I think she entertained people in pubs and places like that. So she just started playing the songs and we all just sang along. The choice of songs was completely hers. But if she brought out something like Irish Eyes Are Smiling, that would be something that we would all know from growing up. We would have heard all the adults singing that. You can imagine getting all this film into the editing suite with Roy Benson, who was our editor. We had a little editing suite in Soho in London, Old Compton Street. It was above a shop. And there was none of your digital. This was film with sound on a separate track where you'd run the picture and the sound together. And I think a lot of the time was just spent trying to figure out which bit went with which bit, with poor old Roy pulling his hair out. But eventually we got it done and put it together, and we took it to the BBC, who we thought would be the ideal place to show it, was on the Christmas holidays, they always had a Boxing Day special, which always got a big television audience. So we thought, oh, this would be great. This would be for our kind of people. It'd be a sort of modern, wacky, surrealist romp. But, of course, we've probably forgot that people were used to seeing a certain kind of variety show. There was a great act called Morecambe and Wise, very famous British entertainers, who were much more professional and funny and were what the audience was used to seeing on Boxing Day. And we were offering this very strange fare. And I think a lot of younger people at home enjoyed it, but a lot of older people, including television critics, didn't. So it got hammered mightily. We had friends who we wanted to rope in. We knew the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and their lead singer, Viv Stancil. So we cooked up this scene where we'd go down to a strip joint in Soho, which is called Raymond's Review Bar. And I think we basically just wanted to see a stripper. It was as simple as that, the truth be known. And so Viv was a great comedian, very clever, funny guy, and the rest of the band understood completely what we were doing and were happy to do their music accompanying a stripper. Again, this came from something that we had done with the Beatles in the very early days. We'd worked in a club and had accompanied a stripper, who I believe was called Janine. And she'd come along and she'd given us all her sheet music, but because we didn't read music, we had to offer her just a couple of songs that we happened to know that we thought might be helpful. And I don't think she was very impressed. She wanted the fire dance, and we gave her Raunchy, which I thought was entirely suitable. This sequence with the Bonzos was based on that memory. And we had back the stripper. I think the best bit for us as a virile young gentleman was that at the end she would turn away from the audience and turn to us as she revealed her nakedness, and we would get the full picture. So I suppose, you know, that was quite amusing at the time. So that became the basis of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band sequence. And the other link was that I had produced them. I had been the producer, Apollo C. Vermouth, which I believe was a moniker that Viv Stancil helped me cook up. A lot of what happened with the Beatles was based on our memories. So songs like Penny Lane was a real place in Liverpool, which held fond memories for us. And Your Mother Should Know, which appears in Magical Mystery Tour, is a sort of almost like a music hall song, which is in the style that our parents would grow up to and we would hear as young kids, and that we'd broken away from as we went into rock and roll. But this sequence found its way, I think, towards the end of the film. We wanted something bigger, a bit of a production number. So we got into our white tuxedos and called upon some dance teams, ballroom dancing teams. And then, of course, everyone would read into it. I mean, later on people would say, why do I have a black carnation and the others have red ones? It was simply that they'd run out of red ones. The only one they had was a black one, and I was the last one to get one. So it was no more significant than that. But of course, in the Beatles' history, these things take on huge significance. Probably adding to the rumour Paul is dead, which happened round about the time of Abbey Road. Anyway, to us, it was just a musical sequence that we were having fun with. We even taught ourselves a dance sequence. We put our hand out to the right, all at the same time. That, to us, was choreography of the highest type. Then we got the whole crew together, with us as the wizards, for the final sequence. And we ran towards the camera. Then we had the traditional camera going up in the sky shot. And once we were up there, we did sequences that were dotted throughout the film, where people all laughed or people all applauded. So that was it. We made up these sequences, went into the editing suite, pieced them together. They did have a sort of a story. We went off on a trip. We did the trip. And we came back singing songs.
And that was a magical mystery tour.
And the wizards appeared to have been in control all the time. But who were the wizards? The wizards were us. Who was the walrus? We will never know. Thank you. And thank you for listening. And thank you to the critics for such kind reviews. Goodbye. Testing, here we are, testing. Continuity. Going where? We don't know. We don't know where we're going. We're really lucky if we get anywhere. Coming back here, you can call up. We're grumbling about the weather, can you? Where are we going? Does anyone know? Where are we going? Going round and round in a day. I live in Bristol, so anything you want to know. Ridge and I did all our courting in Bristol. You know you shouldn't drink vodka. What was he doing? Sexy. Sexy. Didn't you know? Slept in the swimming pool. Morning, Aggie. Morning. Can everybody sit down? Lovely day. Morning, judges. We're singing in the rain. She's a woman, won't she be? No. Yes, what a lady! You're a piss on the lady. Sylvia. Come on. Where's the chocolate? Room Britannia. Room.